na. Yasodhanandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tirabhanachari Yamuna Tirabhanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Vishnupada Panamahansa Padavajakacharya Stotra Sita Shishimada's Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jaya ISKCON BBD Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jaya Jaya Vishnupada Panamahansa Padavajakacharya Stotra Sita Shishimada His Divine Grace Bhaktivedanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj Ki Jaya Ananta Gaudiya Vaishnavinda Ki Jaya Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jaya Premstakaho, Shri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Shri Advaita Giridhar, Shri Bhaskari, Gaura Bhakti Vrindaki, Shri Shri Radhakrishna, Gogopinath, Shyamakunda, Radhakunda, Giddigobadan ki jai, Vrindavan dam ki jai, Nabadweep Mayapur dam ki jai, Ganga Jamunamai ki jai, Talasi Devi Maharani ki jai, Samaveda Bhakti Vrindaki jai, Harinam Sankirtana ki jai, Brihat Madanga ki jai, All glories to the assembled devotees. The assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to Shri Shri Guru Angaranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, third canto, first chapter, text number 40. Aho prita api driyate arbaka arte rajarshi varyena vina api tena ya tu eka Viraha Adirataha Vijigye Danu Dvitiya Kakubaha Chatasraha Aho Pritapi Driyate Bakarte Aho pritapi driyater bakarte Rajarshi varyena vinapitena Rajarshi varyena vinapitena Yas tve kaviro dirato vijigye Yastve kaviro dirato vijigye Dano dvitiya kakubascha tasraha Dano dvitiya kakubascha tasraha Aho pritapi driyater Bakarte Rajarshi Varyena Vinapitena Yastve Kaviro Dirato Vijigye Danor Dvitiya Kakubascha Tasraha Vaishnavis. Aho, O my Lord, Prita, Kunti, Api, also, Driyate, bears her life, Arbaka Arte, for the sake of fatherless children, Vajarshi, King Pandu, Varyena, the best, Vina Api, without him, Tena, him, Ya, one who, two, but, Eka, alone, Viraha, the warrior, Abirataha, commander, Vijigye, could conquer, Danu, the bow, Dvitiya, the second, Kukubaha, directions, Chatasraha 4. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. O my Lord, is Prita still living? She lived only for the sake of her fatherless children. Otherwise, it was impossible for her to live without King Pandu, who is the greatest commander and who alone conquered the four directions simply with the help of a second bow. Purport. A faithful wife cannot live without her lord, the husband, and therefore all widows used to voluntarily embrace the burning fire which consumed the dead husband. This system was very common in India because all the wives were chaste and faithful to their husbands. Later on, with the advent of the age of Kali, the wives gradually began to be less adherent to their husbands, and the voluntary embrace of the fire by the widows became a thing of the past. Very recently, the system was abolished, since the voluntary system had become a forcible social custom. When Maharaj Pandu died, both his wives, namely Kunti and Madhuri, were prepared to embrace the fire, but Madhuri requested Kunti to live for the sake of the younger children, the five Pandavas. This was agreed upon by Kunti at the added request of Vyasadeva. In spite of a great bereavement, Kunti decided to live, not to enjoy life in the absence of her husband, but only to give protection to the children. This incident is referred to here by Vidura because he knew all the facts about his sister-in-law Kunti Devi. It is understood that Maharaj Pandu was a great warrior and that he alone, with the help of a bow and arrow, could conquer the world's four directions. In the absence of such a husband, it was impossible for Kunti to live on, even as a widow. But she had to do it for the sake of the five children. Om gina timananda shajananjana shalakaya chakshuram mulitam yenu tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chaitanya manobhishtam stapitam yena bhutale swayamupa kadamayam dadati swapadantikam. So I'm going to focus on this second aspect of the translation and the purport, which mentioned how Pandu was such a great commander, and he alone was able to conquer the four directions simply with the help of a second bow, as opposed to talking about the Sati rite and, you know, Queen Kunti or Madri entering into the fire of Pandu's cremation. That's been kind of spoken about a lot of times, so I'm going to not go over that and just focus on the second part here, which in the purport Prabhupada said, it is understood that Maharaj Pandu is a great warrior and that he alone, with the help of a bow and arrow, could conquer the world's four directions. And of course, in the translation, it actually says that he did. And then it goes on to say, in the absence of such a husband, it was impossible for Kunti to live on even as a widow, but she had to do so for the sake of the five children. So it's understood that Maharaj Pandu was the emperor of the entire world. And that was how things were done. You know, previously there was one person, one king or one emperor. Actually, I think the king who was kind of in charge of all the other kings, so to speak, that he was referred to as the emperor. And he was ruling the entire world. Maharaj Pandu was not, that was not unique, what's being described here. That was the standard. Before Maharaj Pandu, there was some other emperor who was ruling the entire world. And after Maharaj Pandu, eventually Maharaj Yudhisthira became the emperor. And then his grandson, Maharaj Prickett, became the emperor. So that was going on. And Prabhupada brought this, made this point in his lectures over 30 times. I did some research on it, One King. And I kind of, you know, went through all the different hits, so to speak, on the Veda base. And I found that Prabhupada made this statement, you know, more than 30 times, that previously there was one king, one emperor for the entire planet. So in Melbourne, in 1975, Prabhupada was giving a Srimad Bhagavatam class, and at the end of the class, one lady, female devotee, asked a question about that. She thought that was kind of hard to understand. Anyway, so she asked her question. Madhavisa clarified it. He actually presented it to Prabhupada. So this is Madhavisa speaking. He says to Prabhupada, she's just wondering how it would be possible for one king to rule the whole world. It seems like it's very difficult. It seems like it would be very difficult. Nowadays, we have so many leaders, and still they can't manage. So that was, he was, you know, rephrasing her question and presenting it to Prabhupada. So this is Prabhupada's answer. Prabhupada says, forget that. Why you are thinking that you cannot rule over, therefore others cannot. You are thinking in your term, but there are, meaning there are people who can do that. That is possible. So this was, for me, reminded me of that humorous anecdote Prabhupada would tell about the frog in the well. How there was a frog in a well, and another frog came to him and said, hey, I've seen the Atlantic Ocean. It's incredible. You wouldn't believe how big it is. And the frog in the well said, well, okay, what do you mean? I mean, is it twice as big as this well? And, you know, it went back and forth a little bit first. And then, you know, he said, well, is it twice as big as the well? And he puffed himself up, you know, to say twice the size. And the frog who is the guru frog can't say, no. No, you got to understand. It's like inconceivably bigger than this. And he said, well, the other frog responds, well, is it three times as big as this well? He puffed himself up a bit further. And the other frog said, no, come on. You're not going to be able to. And he said, well, is it four times as big as this well? And he, you know, puffed himself a bit further and he burst. See, so in the process, the purport of that anecdote is in the process of trying to understand the size, the immensity of the Atlantic Ocean in terms of his own experience, he destroyed himself. Okay? So it's an analogy. The idea is that in the process of trying to understand Vedic knowledge in terms of our own experience, we will destroy our attempt for spiritual life. That's not how you understand Vedic knowledge. See, the frog destroyed himself. In the same way, the devotee, the spiritual aspirant who's trying to understand Vedic knowledge in terms of his own experience will not be successful. In the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, who knows, 434, who can quote it? No, 434. Raise your hand. So there's a few very important words in that. One is paripatena, means paying obeisances. Okay? There's one should try to learn the truth by first offering obeisances, then paripashnena, which means inquiring submissively, and then sevaya, on top of that, rendering service, and then upadekshanti te gyanam. Then the self-realized soul will impart knowledge because he has seen the truth. Then, you know, to that person, a person who does those things, he has there's the possibility of things will be revealed to him. So that's the Vedic process. This is the trying to understand inconceivable things the way the frog was doing it, you know, that won't work. And Prabhupada elaborated upon this, this idea of what is the process for understanding inconceivable things. This is a lecture Prabhupada gave. There's an excerpt from this is an excerpt from a lecture Prabhupada gave in Germany, June 19th, 1974. And he's speaking on this point. He says, Achincha kalu ye bhava na tams tarkena yojayat. This is Vedic instruction that things which are beyond your perception, don't try to understand by this foolish argument and logic. Don't try to understand. Achincha kalu ye bhava. Achincha means beyond your conception. Chincha means within your perception. And achincha means beyond your conception. Achincha kalu ye bhava natams tarkena. You cannot understand by this rascal logic and philosophy. That is not possible. Then Prabhupada poses a rhetorical question. He says, then how it is to be understood? You know, how do you understand these things then if you can't understand them using your logic and your intelligence? He says, there are many places. He says, Atak Sri Krishna Namari Nabhaved Girayam Indriye. These blunt senses, you cannot understand Krishna. Krishna's name, Krishna's form, Krishna's qualities, Krishna's activities, you cannot understand. Then once again, he says, and how can I understand? And he goes, it is said, Sevan Mukhehi Jivado. When you engage your tongue in the service of the Lord, when you engage your tongue in the service of the Lord, and then Prabhupada admits, he acknowledges, this is also very peculiar, that to understand, that understand by the tongue, not by the mind. He says, tongue. Tongue means we have got two businesses. We perform with the tongue. One is tasting foodstuff and vibrating voice. So use your tongue vibrating Hare Krishna Maha Mantra and eat Krishna Prasadam. Bas means finished, enough. Then you understand Krishna. You don't understand, but he reveals. So this is our process for understanding knowledge, understanding things that are inconceivable. And pretty much everything in Krishna consciousness is inconceivable. You stop and think about it. You know, it's all inconceivable. I mean, the holy name is non-different from Krishna. The deity is Krishna, etc., etc., on and on and on and on. So we're not going to understand it by the process that the frog used. We have to do it like this. Service, you know, submissively hearing, okay, and then engaging in service. And that service begins with the tongue. Sevan Mukhe Hijivado. That's the title of this thing. Sevan Mukhe Hijivado. So Prabhupada makes that point. How that's how inconceivable things. That's how we possibly can understand them. Engaging in service, and that gets revealed to us. Elsewhere, Prabhupada elaborates upon that. This is an excerpt from a room conversation, September 12, 1976, in Vrindavan. Prabhupada's meeting with the Lokanath Maharaj, and the devotees are doing the bullock cart program. So he says to them, getting right to the heart of it, he says, "So they think speculative mind is the beginning of God consciousness." Speculation, you know. But Shastra says, no, not the mind. Manoratanasati davato bahi. If one is speculator, he will be on the material field. Asato ma sadgama. Don't remain in the asat. Come to the reality. Prabhupada says, that reality begins from the tongue. Sevan muke hijivado. Same thing again. Same point. Transcend the material perception in order to understand Vedic knowledge. So, and then he goes, Sevan, he quotes it again, Sevan Mukhi Jivado, Jivado, Ado. So give them chance to chant Hare Krishna and give them chance to take prasadam. That's all. Jivado. Utilize the tongue primarily. So, same point. And finally, okay, now somebody might respond to this by saying, okay, you know, that's pretty far out. I mean, folks are saying that you understand this inconceivable. I mean, let's take a neophyte devotee comes along, and he's feeling like, okay, you know, there's a lot of inconceivable things that I'm being confronted with here in Krishna consciousness. You're telling me I'm going to understand them. I have to first engage in service. And then they're going to be revealed to me. What if I don't have faith in that process? Well, actually, if you don't have faith in that process, then you're going to stay where you are. Because in Krishna consciousness, the way it works is not like you have faith first and then you engage. The faith comes, real faith comes as a result of engaging. Somebody might start off with some sentiment. That's nice, maybe to get you going. But real faith comes as a result of engaging in the service. And I'll read you, this is an excerpt from a morning walk conversation, Prabhupada, July 21st, 1975, San Francisco. So Prabhupada, this Bahulasva was saying to Prabhupada, Prabhupada responded to something, he says, by service only, he quoted that same verse, you know, line from the Padma Purana, Sevan Mukhi Hijivado, by service only, you can understand God, simply by service. There is no other way. And here it comes. He says, and faith begins from the tongue. Therefore, it is advised that you chant and take prasad. Then faith will come. See, he says, it's not the other way around. It's not like you have faith, oh, and then I'll chant. No. By chanting and taking prasadam, the faith comes, Prabhupada says. Sevan Mukhi Hijivado. The faith begins from the tongue. People will be surprised. Faith must begin from the mind, from the eyes. Why it is said tongue? They do not know. Simply by engaging the tongue in the service of the Lord, I shall understand. So this is also blind faith. Initially, it requires you just kind of got to do it, you know. But if one does makes that leap of faith, so to speak, and chants and takes prasadam, then everything becomes revealed to that person. So there's a famous story in this regard, sort of supporting this point. It's in relation to Prabhupada's spiritual master. There was the anecdote goes something like this, that somebody came, wanted to ask Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj some questions. You know, the disciples were bringing him forward. And so Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj said, you know, first let him go into the kitchen and wash the pots. Let him wash pots in the pot room. So they sent him to wash pots for some amount of time. And then after a while, he said, okay, I'm not busy now. Bring him. And he said, so what is your question? And the man said, oh, no, I don't have any more question anymore. It's all, whatever. My question was answered. In other words, he did the service. He was humble, and he went and did some service. And because he did the service, the answer to his question was revealed to him from within, because he was humble and did the service. And so, you know, that's kind of how devotional service works. We have to have faith in the process. He was fortunate to experience the absolute nature of devotional service. He was like, you know, a brand new person, but he engaged in the service, and the answer to his question was revealed to him. But in general, we have to have faith in, you know, the knowledge we receive from the higher authority. A very good example of that occurred to me about a week and a half ago when we were at Surah's memorial service. Adhira Lalita told the story about how right at the beginning of the pandemic, we had no place to, you know, distribute books. We were kind of all locked down. But Surah he noticed that Dave Arata was distributing some sets and all. So he said to Dira Lalita, he said, "What are you doing?" He said, Dira said, "I'm just, you know, have a few contacts, some students. I'm trying to distribute a few books to these people I've met." And Surah said, "No, come to my office. I'll give you something." So he went to the office, and Surah gave him all these leads to, you know, BBT members. And he told Dira, "Okay, you know, you write some sort of a letter telling you we have some special promotion." And, you know, then we'll send it out to them and see what happens. So Dira had, you know, he had faith in the instruction from the higher authority, and he went ahead and did that. He sent out a letter presenting, making, you know, some appeal. We have a special deal going on. Please take advantage of it. And he sold a whole bunch of sets like that, 15 or more, 15, 20 sets. So, in other words, you get the knowledge from the higher authority, and then you got to work it. You see? You got to work it. And when you do, then you get the result. And that was like an example of that. This might sound really obvious to us, you know, but it's not so obvious. It is obvious to us, okay, maybe. But it's not that obvious to people in general. People in general, the way they want to, because everybody wants to understand the truth about life, right? But generally people tend to, Prabhupada would say Prabhupada's phrase was mental speculation. And I never heard that phrase before I became a devotee, but I'm familiar with the equivalent of that would be philosophize. People like to philosophize. Philosophize means you theorize. Oh, it's like this, it's like that, and speculate. So that's the general tendency among people who aren't devotees to philosophize about what is the truth about life, okay? But as devotees, we don't philosophize. No, we're not interested in we don't philosophize. We kirtanize and prashadamize. That's what we do. That's our process. They can philosophize, but we will kirtanize and prashadamize. Now, to them, they think that you guys are doing nothing. You know, that you're just saying the same thing over and over again, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. How are you supposed to get knowledge doing that? How are you supposed to get knowledge just eating some food that you say is spiritual food? How's that supposed to give you any knowledge? They're totally like, you know, incredulous. But that's their perception of us. But our perception of them is they're actually like a mouse on a treadmill. Have you ever seen that? You know, the mouse in the treadmill? He's going for it, you know, but all he's doing, he's not making any progress. He's not getting any closer to the cheese or whatever it is that he's got in front of him there. He's just wearing himself out. Actually, maybe in the process, maybe he's getting a bit more healthy. You know, maybe he's becoming a bit more physically fit than the other mouse that's sitting next to him in the cage that's not on the treadmill. But he's not getting any closer to the cheese by that process. You don't get any closer. You just keep going around and around and around. Prabhupada said that, and I think Manoratu Rasati Davatopahi, you're on the material, on the chariot of the mind. See? So they think they're making progress. You know, they think that, oh, look, it's obvious we're making progress. Philosophy is evolving. You know, we found faults in some of the arguments presented by Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Philosophers have, you know, carefully analyzed what they've said, and they've formed better arguments. And, you know, look, we could demonstrate to you how down through the ages philosophy has evolved and it's getting more sophisticated. But they're in the material energy. See? So, and those, like for us, that's just like the mouse that's on the treadmill. That mouse might be getting healthier. When you exercise, you get healthier. So the mouse that's on the treadmill, maybe he's getting more fit than the mouse that's just sitting there. But he's still not making any real progress. So that's how we see them. They see us as absolutely making absolutely no progress, and we see them as absolutely making no progress. Prabhupada once said that there's an article in the Bhaktivedanta magazine, Who's Crazy? You know, our perspective is that. They're, you know, Asati Davatobi, yeah, just on the chariot of the mind. And they see us as going nowhere. But we are going somewhere. Because Sevan Mukhehi Jivado. We're engaging in the process of devotional service, beginning with the tongue. And Krishna's pleased by that. And as Prabhupada said, and there's one of those excerpts, or a couple of those excerpts I read, he reveals himself. He reveals himself to us, you know, in different ways, proportionately. Yeah, as they surrender to me, I reward them accordingly. So, once again, you see, it's obvious to us that this is the process of get knowledge. I mean, why is Bhagavad even talking about this? We know this. Yeah, but okay, we do, but it's good to, it's a very fundamental point in our epistemology, you know, so it's good to kind of focus on it again. And once again, you know, the outside world is completely oblivious to this understanding. Actually, they hate it. They hate it, to be honest with you. There's an organization in London. It's called the Royal Society. Actually, Jhutakarma, very prestigious scientific institution. Jhutakarma was invited to speak there, interestingly enough, ironically enough, back 20 years ago or something like that. Some of the Nobel fellows there are like Isaac Newton, Charles Darwin, like that. You know, all the most topmost scientific minds become members of that. So this is their, it's called, the full title is Royal Society for Improving Natural Knowledge. And their motto is nullius in verba, which means take nobody's word for it. So these are the topmost minds in science, right? That's the motto of their society. And their kind of explanation of that, you know, filling it out a bit more, says that it's an expression of their determination of the members to withstand the domination of authority and to verify all statements by an appeal to facts determined by experiment. See, so that's how they like to, that's their approach to getting knowledge. They want to do experiments which will provide facts, and they get knowledge like that. But what they don't realize is actually they're also taking an authority. And I'll give an example of that. Maybe 5 years ago, between 5 and 10 years ago, I was doing Sankirtan up at the observatory. And through going there a few times, I learned who the director was. The director is this man. It was kind of interesting because he drove up in this really old car, but the people who worked there said, "Oh, that's the director." You know, I was wondering, what's that old car doing in the reserve parking spot? And I asked somebody, and it worked out it was the car for the director. You know, it was like one of these like 1957 something or others, but it wasn't even like all customized, and you know, it was just like looked like it was from 1957. So he's a kind of bit of a character, apparently. But his name is Ed Krupp, and he's been the director there for 40 years. So I thought, okay, you know, let me just see if I could talk to this guy. You know, so he went one morning when he pulled in, he parked, and he was starting to walk from the place in his parking spot to the observatory. So I kind of sort of tagged along with him. I said, "Hey, Mr. Krupp, you got to." I can't remember exactly what I asked him, but I said, "Hey, how is it that scientists have so much confidence in the Big Bang? I mean, Nobody saw it. And even if the greatest astrophysicists would, you know, put their telescopes up there, nobody sees anything moving. So how is it that scientists have so much faith in it? You know, because it didn't seem like to be bared out by evidence. Nobody saw it." even when they put their tele, because you know that's a theory states that everything's moving away, the Big Bang. You know, there was some Big Bang, and all everything in the universe is moving away from each other. Okay, and they. So anyway, so his response was, he didn't give me much of an answer. He just said, well, no, we have observational evidence. Observational evidence. So now I'm going to say something about that. This is a, I'm going to just read a couple paragraphs from this book that was written by Sariputta Das called Vedic Cosmography and Astronomy. So he goes, up until the early part of this century, scientists believed that the basic objects in the universe were static in relation to one another. So that's what people used to believe. And then in 1913, the American astronomer Vesto Melvin Slipper came to study the spectra of light coming from a dozen prominent nebulae. Nebulae is like a cloud, which they used to think was a cloud, but it works out they were galaxies. Anyway, and he concluded that they were moving away from the Earth at speeds of up to 2 million miles per hour. Now, here, this is where it gets interesting. Okay, so how did Slipper reach this astonishing conclusion? For some time, astronomers had been using spectrographic analysis to determine the elements present in the stars. It was known that the spectrum of light associated with a particular element will show a characteristic pattern of lines that serve as a kind of signature for the element. Slipper noticed that in the spectra of galaxies he studied, the lines for certain elements were shifted toward the red part of the spectrum. This curious phenomenon is called a redshift, okay? And it says here, Slipper interpreted the redshift as a Doppler effect. Okay, I stopped there. He interpreted. See, he saw something. He saw these the spectral lines shifting to the red. That's what he actually saw. But then he interprets that, oh, that's a red. That's a redshift. It's a Doppler effect. The Doppler effect is the effect that you get like a, if you have like a bunch of guys on a flatbed truck, they're playing the a horn or something like that, and the truck starts moving away, and the, you know, go, as the sound moves away from you, the pitch goes down. See? So he interpreted it as something like that, that, oh, this is an indication. All he saw was a red, a different, you know, the red spectral lines, but he interpreted that as a Doppler effect, and that means that everything's moving away from each other. Back to what I said to, you know, Professor Krupp. When scientists look in the telescopes, nobody saw the Big Bang, and nobody sees the Big Bang today. When scientists look in their telescopes, they don't see anything moving away from anything else. They just see static images. So where do you get this idea that everything's moving away from this? But what is it? It's an interpretation. They're interpreting. See? So this determination of the fellows that they don't want to be dominated. They don't want to be. They want to withstand the domination of authority and to verify all statements by an appeal to facts that are determined by experiment. See, but facts have to be interpreted. Like this is an example. He saw those red spectral lines, but he came up with there are other theories. In other words, in more recent years, other astrophysicists have come up with other explanations for how those red spectral lines get there, you know, which I won't go into. But the point is this, that, you know, they're thinking, oh, no, we don't want to be dominated by an authority. We want the facts, and nothing but the facts. But the facts have to be interpreted. And then somebody interprets, even in the science world, somebody interprets the facts, like this fellow here, Schilper, and he forms a theory, and then they all go with that. But it's no different. They're also just getting knowledge from an authority like that. So anyway, so like I said, our process is different. We have to try to avoid this tendency to mentally speculate. Prabhupada says in one purport in the Bhagavad Gita that mental speculation that leads one away from the conclusion that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of God is a dangerous sin. Everybody remember that purport? This statement like that in some place, early chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. And actually this tendency to speculate or doubt, it's actually even, in one sense, is even more dangerous than a material desire. You know, because when you have say you have a material desire, it's, say you're walking along the street and you see like a really beautiful woman and you feel lusty, or in the case of the women, a really beautiful, handsome man and you feel lusty. So you know, wait, no, I'm not supposed to be thinking like that. Check that, you know. It's obvious. But in the case of like a doubt arises in your mind. How could Krishna lift Govardhan Hill? Or how could Krishna expand himself into 16,184? It seems like, because we're conditioned, cultural conditioning is such that, you know, it's encouraged to doubt what you get from an authority. So you don't have the same knee-jerk reaction to when a doubt enters into your mind as opposed to a material desire. So you tend to just kind of let it, but it's the same thing. It's just, as it says in the Bhagavad Gita, avritam gyanam etena gyanino nichavairina kama rupena kunteya duspadein analena chada. Lust is never satisfied. It burns like fire. Same thing with doubts. I'll just modify that a little bit, because just like with sex desire, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, kamosmi bhadatarsaba, that, you know, sex life that's not contrary to religious principles, I am. So there is a way. You know, sex life is not totally destructive. If you engage in sex life that's not contrary to religious principles, means you get married and you have children, you have sex life for the purpose of producing Krishna conscious children, it's okay. It's not destructive. It's not like what Krishna's talking about, burns like fire and is never satisfied. That's the proper utilization of lust. So in the same way, if somebody has a doubt, you know, doesn't understand something, they approach a proper authority and they accept what the authority says, that's okay. Archie Dogs makes this point. I think he made it in the last class he was giving, that, if you approach an authority, reveal your mind about something that kind of, you know, is bewildering you or something, then you got to accept what that person says. And if you do, that's good. That's bona fide. But then if you just kind of keep, even after hearing the proper explanation, if you don't accept that and you just keep, then you're just like that mouse on the treadmill. You know, no progress, and it's just like lust. Never satisfied, and it burns like fire. It's destructive. So, what's the time? Please, somebody tell me. All right, we'll stop there. Anybody have any question about anything I said? First question is Dave Rathabu.
Simultaneously, Kapila Dave explains that doubt is it's an expression of the intelligence. And if we just have devotees in our movement that don't learn how to think for themselves, I mean, a lot of problems can arise, you know, like we see in the past that there was instances where it was this kind of like a blind following, and from that a lot of problems arose.
It's distorting your voice.
We can see that through blind following within any tradition, it can create a lot of problems within the society. And it's really the thinkers who think and question and doubt and try to establish a solution that can actually, you know, change the course of a society. But initially, when they're doubting, they're not really appreciated very much. So how do we understand this point that Kapila Dev is making, that, you know, doubt is an application of our intelligence? Because if we see something that's wrong and we doubt it, but simultaneously you could have someone who's apparently authority saying this is a good thing, then how do we adjust that? Because, according to our philosophy, you have to surrender to an authority, but simultaneously we have to engage our intelligence to put two and two together. If there's something that we're seeing and there's something in Prabhupada's books that aren't aligning, but then there's an external circumstance where they're saying this is an authority and you have to accept it, but it's not aligning with the Siddhanta. So how do we manufacture it?
Within our society, there's a hierarchy of authority. And in the absence of Srila Prabhupada, the buck stops with the GBC. So, for instance, say something's happening on a local level, and you think this is not our philosophy, this is not Prabhupada's teaching, and you're not satisfied with what your Sankirtan leader says, or your temple president says, okay, you can, in a respectful, sort of a humble way, take it to the point of your GBC, and then you have to accept that, because that's, Prabhupada said that they're the authority, you know. I don't think, to be a member in good standing in ISKCON, you got to accept what the GBC says. Or certainly, if you're not happy with any one particular GBC, then you could maybe, but the idea is the GBC is the ultimate authority on issues.
But there's also instances, and I'm just playing devil's advocate, there's also instances where the GBC was wrong on a particular issue.
Right. So Prabhupada addressed that. There was times when Prabhupada got letters and stuff, and he told the devotees that you follow what your authority says, you're doing the right thing, and if they're off, then Krishna's going to correct it, but you're doing the right thing by following them. You know, Prabhupada didn't want anarchy. He wanted devotees to follow the principle of higher authority. See? I mean, as I said, that one of the basic things, in the basic point of the class was, we're not philosophizers, we're kirtanizers and prashadamizers. And so our thing is, we accept from the authority, and we dig in to the process of hearing and chanting and taking prashadam. Our problems are going to be worked out that way, not by making mental adjustments, not by this, that, the other thing, going here, going there. No. Just really digging in, taking shelter of the process, hearing and chanting, taking prashadam. Things will be revealed in due course of time. Archie, do you want to say something? Yeah.
Thank you for the nice class, Prabhu. There are really two different things. What you said and what he's asking is actually two different things. You're speaking about accepting a version of reality that doesn't sit well with everybody else who are not devotees. For instance, Prabhupada saying they didn't go to the moon. That blew a lot of his followers' minds because they were conditioned to accept the scientific presentation that, yes, we took off from Cape Canaveral and we went to the moon and we stayed there for a few days and we came back. They were pre-programmed to accept that. So when Prabhupada said it didn't happen, they blew their minds. But again, our process is a descending process of philosophical knowledge. You say kirtanize and prasadamize, but we also philosophize by accepting the descending process of philosophy.
Right.
So for instance, to this day, there are people who are researching how many different species of fish are in the ocean. We don't have to do that. Jalaja Navalakshani, 900,000 species in the water. You can spend the rest of millions of lifetimes trying to figure it out. We already accepted it, 900,000. So this is a different thing from what he's talking about. And he's talking now about practical application of day-to-day. But Prabhupada also dealt with that. You can't run a society without discipline. And discipline means you have to accept authority. You can't have a society of 2 million different authorities. It doesn't work. So on a day-to-day basis, you have to accept leadership, you have to accept authority, which is actually natural. Natural in any society, even animal society, there's an alpha male and alpha female. It's just a natural tendency for living entities to have a leader. But in Kali Yuga, nobody wants to be led. Everybody wants to be a leader. And therefore, you have this chaos. But in our society, we know what the philosophy is, and we should follow the authorities in applying that philosophy. Which means, again, the example I like to use is very simple. Let's say you're top book distributor, but the authorities say, we need you to stay back and manage a temple. You may say, but no, but Prabhupada said book distribution is the highest. No, you have to accept what the authority says, or just vice versa. You're very happy being the head pujari, but now the authorities say, we want you to go out on the street every day. You can say, well, no, that is what accepting authority means. If you do whatever you like only, then you haven't accepted authority. Then you accepted yourself as the authority. And that doesn't work. You can't have, you know, a temple, even of 50 devotees, where everyone accepts themselves as authority. You're going to have chaos. So we have to use our intelligence to see if the authority is presenting what the predecessor authority presented. So in our case, we have Prabhupada clearly stating on everything. You can look in the Prabhupada Shikshamrita on anything, marriage, zits, anything. You can look up. So if a local temple authority is going off the track from what Prabhupada presented, then you have a right to be concerned. But otherwise, we have to accept a line of authority. It's just you can't get around it. You can't philosophize yourself away from that. there has to be authority. Not only in our society, even let's say the U.S. Army. It's a voluntary army, right? You don't have to go anymore. But if you go there and say, look, you know, I like your guys' mission, but I don't like your uniforms and I don't like this. You can't. Once you join the army, you have to follow what they say. And if you don't, especially in critical situations, you can be court-martialed, put in jail for not following the instruction, even though you voluntarily joined. So now you've voluntarily joined the International Society for Christian Consciousness. There is, Prabhupada said, Christian consciousness has to be executed as if in military discipline, which means an authority structure, sergeant, lieutenant, general, major, like that. You have to get into that mood. If you don't, you're always going to be spinning around wanting to do your own thing, and it doesn't work. You can't have, even in a local temple, 50 authorities doing whatever they want to do. It doesn't work. It becomes chaotic. So we go out in Harinam, and I can't even keep people in two lines. It's frustrating. I go on Harinam in Europe, the devotees are trained. They just naturally line up. Two lines and we go along the street nicely. You go on the Santa Monica Promenade, they want to be five across, six across. Everybody's saying, it doesn't work. You have to have an authority structure and follow the authority. So you don't have to get beaten at every moment to do this, don't do that. Just follow the authority.
Sachi, I know you want to say something. Sachi, yeah.
It's in a different
topic. Thank you. Thank you for that. That was a great comment. Thank you.
Different topic. You were focusing on faith, and you quote the verse, Jiva Mukhi Jivado. And you were mentioning that real faith starts when devotional service comes. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I was thinking in an analysis that actually, for example, a guy who's going to jump in a parachute, he has never done it before. It's going to be his first time. But it requires a little bit of faith of that. Because you say, it's not like faith requires before. When you were mentioning that real devotion, that's actually correct. I understand that too. But it does require a little faith to engage. Ado srada tato sadhu sangha.
Yeah, a little something.
Ado srada, that little something.
So get started.
My point was that there's a little faith before that. Then when this guy becomes expert in parachute jumping, he becomes like a real faith. But real faith begins a little bit to, like all of us, we didn't have any faith. And just by approaching a saintly person, faith developed. So that was the only point.
Yeah, yeah, I tried to touch upon that. Initially, there has to be some sentiment, otherwise you wouldn't even come to try it. But, you know, developing the real mature faith, implicit faith, that only comes as a result of engaging in the process. You know, we have to Sevan Mukhi Hi Jivado. You have to do the chanting, take prasadam, and then the real faith, that mature faith will develop. Okay, thank you very much. Gunjo Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
System and stuff like that. You have mystic powers, you could do so much stuff.
Well, they must have some.
Yeah, but it's mentioned as mystic.
You know, to speak of travel around and enforce things, I mean, it's talking about 5,000 years ago, the rest of Analta didn't have telephones or television or internet. So how did they even communicate?
Well, they had television in the sense that, I mean, Sanjay was able to see.
That's mystical.
They had mystic powers back then.
Yeah,
so the emperor.
It
mentions, you look at, there's, it says the different paraphernalia of the emperor, and one of those is he has mystic powers. Right in the Bhagavatam.
Yeah, it's good. So, that devotee was doubting, you know, Madhavisa was presenting her doubt that, how's that possible? And that's one person who probably said, forget that.
Yeah.
Don't try to understand their situation in terms of your situation, because it's too, you can't. Like the frog in the well. The frog was trying to understand the Atlantic Ocean in terms of his own experience as well. And in the process of doing that, he blew himself up and destroyed himself. So in the same way, if you try to understand stuff in the Vedic and Prabhupada's books in terms of our own experience, it isn't going to work. You've got to accept this. It's conceivable. And the way to understand the inconceivable stuff is to surrender to the process, engaging devotional service, and it gets revealed to you in due course of time. When you please spiritual master, you please Krishna. That's the point I was trying to make.
Again, as far as following authority goes,